So for a few weeks now, we've been in the book of Job, and we... That's kidding, that's a joke. I'm feeling very jokey right now, as you can't tell. Maybe the caffeine, I don't know, or the fried chicken. Anywho, we'll start. For a few weeks now, we've lingered on the speeches of the young man Elihu at the end or the beginning of the end of Job, and I hope you have enjoyed what has proven to be, I think, some thoughtful debate and conversation about whether this is the speeches of a young arrogant fool or a righteous prophet sent by God as a preparatory voice before God will come and speak to Job. Tonight, I am sorry to say that most of the controversial elements of Elihu are now in the rearview mirror. But as I went through this, there's still some of it, so don't worry, we'll still have some lively conversation this evening. In chapter 36 and 37, Elihu, as he comes to his final words to Job, the final words from another human to Job in the book of Job, come here. And as he does this, he only has 2 points to make. I've made little indentions here for these 2 points, if you can read the board. First, God's might over all people. And second, God's might over all creation. And at the end of each of these points, Elihu will make a final appeal to Job. It's those moments that, depending how you take the young man Elihu, will depend how you view those final appeals to him. But before we get to these 2 points, notice there is an intro in verse 1 to 4 in chapter 36 and an outro in chapter 37, verse 21 to 24, where he's going to introduce this last speech and he's going to close it out. This is how it's framed. So let's look at the intro in chapter 36, verse 1 to 4. And Elihu continued and said, "Bear with me a little." Some of you have borne long if you take the negative view of him. "And I will show you, for I have yet something to say on God's behalf. I will get my knowledge from afar and ascribe righteousness to my Maker. For truly, my words are not false. One who is perfect in knowledge is with you." So, let's see what's going on here. He first appeals to Job to continue bearing with him. He has spoken more than any other person in the book besides Job himself. And perhaps Job needs an encouragement to continue listening to him because he has been so long-winded. But why should Job keep bearing with Elihu? Because Elihu has words to say on God's behalf. That's why, according to Elihu, he has words to say on God's behalf. Words that he's gotten from afar, or we should think from heaven. Words that will ascribe righteousness to the God in heaven from whom his words come. Words that are not false, but rather words that are perfect. Elihu is not claiming to be arrogant here. He is claiming to be the prophet sent by God. You can agree with him or you can disagree with him here, but see what he's saying. If he truly is the prophet of God, his words are correct. If he's not, his words are a bit out of bounds. Now, Elihu's final words begin with his first point in chapter 36, verse 5 to verse 15, God's might over all people. "Behold, God is mighty and does not despise any. He is mighty in strength of understanding. He does not keep the wicked alive, but gives the afflicted their right. He does not withdraw his eyes from the righteous, but with kings on the throne. He sets them forever, and they are exalted. And if they are bound in chains and caught in the cords of affliction, then he declares to them their work and their transgressions, that they are behaving arrogantly. He opens their ears to instruction and commands that they return from their iniquity. If they listen and serve him, they complete their days in prosperity and their years in pleasantness. But if they do not listen, they perish by the sword and die without knowledge. The godless in heart cherish anger. They do not cry for help when he binds them. They die in youth, and their life ends among the cult prostitutes. He delivers the afflicted by their affliction. Notice that. Do not miss that phrase. He delivers the afflicted by their affliction and opens their ear by adversity. The subject of God's might comes squarely into view as Elihu begins talking. And this continues to be the dominant theme throughout his final words. Behold, God is mighty is not only here in verse 5, but it's also at other key moments throughout these two chapters as well. Think verse 22, verse 26, and 37, 23. They're all transitionatory moments, either coming into a speech or an appeal or coming out of a speech or an appeal. God's might is in view. So whether wicked, afflicted, or righteous, God's might and strength consists in the fact that his purposes are never thwarted, his purposes are never confused, and his purposes are never limited in any way by man. Verse 6 and 7 make this clear, as it shows that the wicked cannot stop God's might in their judgment, and the afflicted righteous cannot but enjoy God's might in his ultimate and gracious deliverance from their trials to the places of honor. In verse 8, God shows his might. Even when the righteous are bound in chains and caught in cords of suffering and affliction. And in verse 9 and 10, God's might is seen in revealing to the righteous the true nature of their hearts, the depths of their sin and arrogance, and in teaching and commanding them to repent and return to him. This gracious gift of God toward the righteous, or we want to say those righteous in him, is a gift God does not give to the wicked. Since they refuse to repent, God allows the wicked to continue on in their sin while humbling all who come before him in repentance. Then Elihu, in verse 11 to 15, expands. He takes this idea and expands on it, and what this means for the righteous by presenting something of a sandwich of contrasts. A sandwich of contrasts. So I'm going to keep this here. I want you to just imagine. Give me a meat that you guys enjoy. Roast beef. Imagine an Arby's sandwich here. Bun. Whatever those buns. They're big. Bun. Roast beef, right? This is what Elihu's doing in verse 11 to 15. Look at this. So, I say sandwich because the righteous are described in verse 11 and verse 15. That's the bread, the pieces of the bread, 11 and 15. The wicked are described in verse 12 to 14, and that's the roast beef of the sandwich. So, 11, 15, 12, 14. In verse 11 and 15, Elihu says it's the righteous who listen to God and serve God, who experience God completing their days and years in prosperity and pleasantness. You may think, isn't this something of a prosperity gospel here? It sounds like that. But I think that can be ruled out by verse 15. Because even the righteous experience a kind of, not prosperity gospel, but our commentator, Christopher Ashe, says here, an adversity gospel. An adversity gospel. in that God delivers the afflicted righteous through their afflictions, and it's in their suffering adversity that their ears are opened to His truth. That's not the prosperity gospel. It's the adversity gospel. It's the opposite. So that's the bread. Now for the meat. In verse 12 to 14, we see the contrast in view. Here, the wicked are the godless, who do not listen to God, who do not serve God, but cherish anger and don't cry out for help in their distress. They don't cry out for help in their distress. For this, the wicked perish. For this, they die by the sword without knowledge, often dying young. And notice, as sadly we often see today, often dying in a stinking pile of their own immorality. Among the cult prostitutes, their sin has led them down a road where that will eventually be the means by which God will destroy them. He gives them what they want. Like Romans 1 talks about, the end of the wicked is as horrible as the end of the righteous is beautiful. This is how God shows His might over all people. This is His point. Now here comes the first appeal then to Job. Elihu, in verse 16 to 25, will apply these things to Job. And he says this in verse 16 to 25. Notice the you present here in 16. That's the transition. He's no longer talking just in general. He's talking right to Job. He also allured you out of distress into a broad place where there was no cramping. And what was set on your table was full of fullness. Full of fatness. But you are full of the judgment on the wicked. Judgment and justice seize you. Beware, lest wrath entice you into scoffing. And let not the greatness of the ransom turn you aside. Will your cry for help avail you, avail to keep you from distress or all the force of your strength? Do not long for the night when peoples vanish in their place. Take care, do not turn to iniquity, for this you have chosen rather than affliction. Behold, God, again, might, is exalted in His power. Who is a teacher like Him? Who has prescribed for Him His way? Or who can say, you have done wrong? Remember to extol His work of which men have sung. All mankind has looked on it, and man beholds it from afar. Like I said, you can be certain here that I think Elihu makes a shift of talking generally in verse 16 to talking directly to Job, because the you comes back into view in verse 16. It also remains personal until verse 25, when Elihu transitions to his next point about God, talking about His might once again. Behold, God is great. This is his next point. And as you'll see, he's talking about something a little different there. But in this first appeal, in verse 16 to 25, Elihu is seeking to apply God's might over all people that he just talked about to Job in verse 16, stating that God has been alluring him out of distress into a broad place before a table full of fatness to enjoy. It may sound strange to our modern sensibilities that fatness is something to enjoy. Think feasting here. Feasting, not just a pile of lard before you on a big picnic table, okay? Think feasting, full of fat feasting to enjoy. Their culture did not have the same virtues and values and physical shape and skinniness and diet like ours does. So this would have been valued. The trouble Elihu sees is that rather than Job being full of the fatness of the table that God has put before him, Elihu says that Job seems to be full of the false judgments, the kind of false judgments that wicked people make about God. Rather than being full from the fatness of God's table, Elihu says, Job, you seem to be full of wicked judgments against God that wicked people make about God. Thus, the counsel that Elihu gives is to beware this kind of talk in verse 18. Don't seek to save yourself in verse 19. Don't long for the hidden dark of night in verse 20. And be careful to not turn to sin instead of affliction in verse 21. And then in verse 22 to 25, Elihu reminds Job of God's might as a great teacher over all people. No one teaches God. No one teaches God. No one has more knowledge than God does. And no one can therefore be able to say to God, you don't know this and therefore you're doing it wrong. Listen to me so you can gain knowledge and therefore do it right. Elihu says no one can do this. No, Job must remember. He must remember to respond to all that God is teaching him in his affliction. Respond with humble acknowledgement of who God is, a humble praise rather than an arrogant protest. And then we see the wonderful verse in 24 and 25. For ages of which men have sung. There has been a great song going on since Genesis 1 about God's greatness, about his unsearchable knowledge that no one can teach him. Men have sung of this. And rather than responding in protest to God and his suffering, Job must join the song. He must join the choir, put the robe on and sing in a humble acknowledgement of who God is and who he is not. But we quickly must remember, Job has suffered, yes. But the proper response to God in suffering is not protest, but humble submission. Recognizing that he is creator and we are creature. This is what Elihu appeals to Job in his first appeal in his final words here. But his counsel isn't over. We get one more little bitty speech and one more appeal from him as he continues into his second point. So he showed us that God's might is over all people. And now he's going to show us in 26 to 37:13 that God's might is over all creation as well. Behold, God is great, and we know him not. The number of his years is unsearchable. For he draws up the drops of water. They distill his mist in rain, which the skies pour down and drop on mankind abundantly. Can anyone understand the spreading of the clouds, the thunderings of his pavilion? Behold, he scatters his lightning about him and covers the roots of the sea. For by these he judges peoples. He gives food in abundance. And he covers his hands with the lightning and commands it to strike the mark. Its crashing declares his presence. The cattle know this and also declare that he rises. At this also my heart trembles and leaps out of its place. Keep listening to the thunder of his voice and the rumbling that comes from his mouth. Under the whole heaven he lets it go, and his lightning to the corners of the earth. After it his voice roars. He thunders with his majestic voice, and he does not restrain the lightnings when his voice is heard. God thunders wondrously with his voice. He does great things that we cannot comprehend. For he says to the snow, fall on the earth. Likewise to the downpour, his mighty downpour. He seals up the hand of every man, that all men whom he made may know it. Then the beasts go into their lairs and remain in their dens. From its chamber comes the whirlwind and cold from the scattering winds. By the breath of God, ice is given. and the broad waters are frozen fast. He loads the thick cloud with moisture. The clouds scatter his lightning. They turn around and around by his guidance to accomplish all that he commands them on the face of the habitable world. Whether for correction or for his land, notice, or for love, he causes it to happen. That last verse is very meaningful for what Elihu is getting at here. As he begins his second main point, behold, God is mighty over the weather. He is in charge of the weather department. He does not stand on the weather channel as if he can barely hang in there with the wind while people just nice strolly walk behind him. As some of you saw on social media, hilariously. God's greatness is over all that he has made in creation. His greatness is unsearchable. Where do we see this? Rain. That's where he goes. Isn't that interesting? If you were to say, tell me about God's great works, what would your answer be? Elihu says, rain. And not just rain, but the process of evaporation to precipitation. And you think about it back then, this was life or death for them. With crops and harvest in play, with precipitation, if it doesn't rain, they don't eat and they die. If it does, they eat and have plenty. And so a great work for them. God's works are great and unsearchable. How? Rain. It's the simple things in life that I think we too often pass by. Perhaps more dramatic after rain in verse 27 and 28 is God's unsearchable greatness in a thunderstorm in the sky. In verse 29 to 33, where the clouds spread out thick, the lightning flashes, the thunder rumbles underneath the pavilion of the sky. By thunderstorms, God's might is seen in both blessing and cursing. Notice, everyone in the storm and within earshot of this storm knows that God is present, even the cows. Perhaps there's something here with the end of Jonah, where even the cattle in Nineveh were aware of what were going on, and Jonah's not, or he refuses to be. This is not to make a case for the wisdom of cattle, but it is to make a case that creation is aware of its maker. And underneath the pavilion of the sky, when the thunders roar, they're aware that their maker is at work. Perhaps the point is that God can curse by storms, destroying land and home and city and crop, just as he can bless by storms and cause fertile growth for food and harvest. And God can do both of these in the same storm. Just as he can bless the righteous through affliction and curse the wicked through affliction. It's what I think verse 31 is seeming to teach us. And then as chapter 37 begins, Elihu expands on this storm and the might of God present in it, but not just the storm. It's still the storm imagery, but now it's the storm imagery intended to show us that in the storm, God's might is only present, but it's the might of his voice that now we hear in the thunder, which we get an entire psalm on this. Psalm 29. The glory of God thunders majestically as his voice rattles over creation. Verse 1 and 2 shows Elihu's response. his heart trembling and leaping out of its place as he listens to God's voice. Why? Because verse 3 and 4, lightning spread from corner to corner, thunder roaring, majestic and unrestrained. And his conclusion to witnessing God's might in the storm is in verse 5. God thunders wondrously with his voice. He does great things that we cannot understand. What great things? He goes back to the simple things. Commanding the snow, commanding the mighty downpours, sealing up the hands of men, sending beasts and all kinds of animals back into their caves or dens, letting loose the whirlwind, the freezing ice, and the fat clouds thick with moisture, making them turn round and round to accomplish his purpose. Those are the great things that Elihu has in store, that he wants Job to remember. And all these things in verse 6 to 13 move immediately by one thing: the voice of God. They move immediately by one thing. I'll never forget the first moment I ever heard a Paul Washer sermon. I felt like I had never been a Christian before as I heard him preach. And he said something like, God says to the seas, stop right there, and they obey. God says to the lightning, crash right here, and they obey. God says to the birds, fly like this, and they obey. He says to the cows, moo like this, and they obey. He says to this, they obey, obey, obey. And then he says, man, do this. And man says, no. And I was like, goodness gracious. There's something of this for us to see here. Notice the end there in verse 13. Whether for correction or for his land or for love, he causes these things to happen. Creation is therefore the theater of God's might, the theater of the power of his glory, where he wields the weather to let man know who he is and who they're not. He does this for correction. He does this for the land. He does this for love. He causes these things to happen. All through the same storm, blessing for the righteous, affliction for the righteous, cursing for the wicked, afflicting for the wicked. This all prepares the way for Elihu's second, and you ready for it? The very last words of Elihu in the book. Come in, well, verse 21 to 24 in the outro. But here, this is his last speech to Job. The last words to Job in 14 to 20. Hear this, O Job. Stop and consider the wondrous works of God. Do you know how God lays his command upon them and causes the lightning of his cloud to shine? Do you know the balancings of the clouds, the wondrous works of him who is perfect in knowledge? You whose garments are hot when the earth is still because of the south wind, can you, like him, spread out the skies hard as a cast metal mirror? Teach us what we shall say to him. We cannot draw up our case because of darkness. Shall it be told him that I would speak? Did a man ever wish that he would be swallowed up? Notice what he said. Hear, stop, consider. Do you know? Do you know? Can you know? Shall it be? These are all the final calls to Job from Elihu as he will prepare to stop speaking to him. He urges and he pleads with Job to hear and heed and be humbled by what he can learn from and about God from the world that God rules over. or particularly God's might displayed in how he wields the weather for his glory. Only God knows how these things operate, and Job does not. Therefore, Elihu's counsel remains consistent. It is dangerous for any man to draw up an argument and make his case against God. Rather, we should not protest, but we should bow down before his unsearchable might. Now for the outro. In verse 21 to 24, the literal last words of Elihu, perhaps some of you are thankful, or you'll miss him. This is what he says. And now no one looks on the light when it is bright in the skies, when the wind has passed and cleared them. Out of the north comes golden splendor. God is clothed with awesome majesty. The Almighty, we cannot find him. He is great in power. Justice and abundant righteousness he will not violate. Therefore, men fear him. He does not regard any who are wise in their own conceit. Thus the words of Elihu are ended. In other words, when the storms of life, there's a pun there, literal and figurative, did you catch that? When the storms of life pass, people rarely look back over them and think what they can learn from them. But we ought to. And in looking back over these storms, Job here and we must be unswaggered as we're reminded of our creatureliness. And we must lose any sense of being wise in our own eyes. And what must we do, therefore, in its place? We must fear God. Elihu says these things because he believes that Job needs to do these things, that he needs to repent, stop talking, and fear the Lord. And as God comes next to speak, what does he do? But continue the very theme of God's might over creation for the next, basically the remainder of the book, for 38, 39, 40, and 41, 63 questions that God asked Job, all of which Job must respond, not I, but you. They're all rhetorical, and Job is meant to be humbled by them. And in this humbling, Job is unswaggered and comes in 42 to fear the Lord. So Elihu really is a preparatory voice for the greater voice to come.